Do you want a drink?
Yeah, sure. White Russian.
There's a special rung in hell reserved for people who waste good scotch.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Try the wine.
You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice.
It comes in pints?
Oh, I'm getting one.
I drink, and I know things.
Hi, welcome to episode 6 of the Ruminations podcast. I'm Steve, and I'm here with Chris, and we will be talking about our trip to the Eternal City. The week after Easter, we went to Rome, Italy. Chris, you went when?
So I went to Italy, it'll be 2 years this summer, and that was my first time being in Italy, and I did a tour with my parents, so we went to Venice, Florence, Rome, and the Amalfi Coast. but this trip we took was just to
Rome. Just to Rome, and this was my first time going to the city of Rome. We kind of just wanted to go through a little bit of our trip and give some history background, because the trip was about two things that are near and dear to both of us, which is ancient Rome and Catholicism.
Right.
Being Rome, we got to go to two countries at once, because we went to the Rome, Italy, and
the smallest country on earth,
Vatican City. So I think first and foremost, it was the most profound thing that I experienced in Rome. I don't know if you agree or not, but
it's definitely one of the top things. I don't think I would say it's my all-time favorite thing, but I really liked
it. Okay. Well, it definitely affected me very much, to the point where I came back and I read two books about St. Peter's. But the thing that was really profound, and it not everybody experiences it when they go to Rome, and that is the Scavi tour, in the tour of the necropolis under St. Peter's Basilica. And the point of that tour is to see the tomb of St. Peter himself.
I feel like just a quick
thing
about how So in order to get this tour, you have to book it ahead of time. So you need to contact, in Italian, the Ufficio Scavi, which is the Scavi office. And I tried to do that, and we planned this trip maybe, I don't know,
like 2 months before.
Yeah. And I tried to get tickets for the Scavi tour, and they were telling me no. You know, we didn't have any tickets left. Maybe it was because it was right after Easter, and there's a lot of tourists. I don't know why. So then I tried every which way to get this. I tried going to the priest that I know. I tried going to a few friends. No one could get us a ticket. And then I asked the Scavi tour. I'm like, well, maybe we could do the tour in Italian or another language just so we can see it. Because I'm like, I don't want to go to Rome and not see this tour. Nothing worked. So then we got in touch with, both Steve and I. Our Knights of Columbus. So we got in touch with one of our fellow knights, and he said he would look into it. And I think a week later he contacted me, and he said he emailed me confirmation for two tickets, and they were both reserved under Cardinal Burke. I thought that was pretty impressive.
So it helps to have friends in high places.
Yeah, because without him we would not have seen that tour.
Right. The idea of the Scavi tour is that the tomb itself wasn't discovered until the 1940s.
But the tradition was always held that Peter was buried under the high altar of St. Peter's Basilica. But they didn't have, I guess, the proof of it.
No. So the tradition says that Peter died in, 64, 65 A.D.?
Mm-hmm.
He was crucified upside down in Nero's Circus.
Right.
Across from the obelisk of Caligula. And that was outside the city, and there was a burial ground there because you weren't allowed to be buried in the ancient city. And St. Peter didn't want to be crucified like Jesus, so he requested to be crucified in a different way, so they killed him upside down. This was, of course, after, if you remember from episode 3 of our podcast, we talk about the movie Quo Vadis. So this was after Peter, the legend says that Peter saw a vision of Jesus telling him that he had to go back to Rome to be crucified a second time. So Peter then returned to Rome to meet his demise. So he's crucified upside down, and they bury his body where he was killed, because that's where they buried the bodies. And since there's not many primary sources from that time, you get secondary sources from 100 years later, 200 years later. And there was a trophy placed on that hill that the Christians had
memorialized the site of Peter.
So the idea was, okay, someone important was buried here. So then when Constantine, which we'll talk about because we saw his big face at one of the museums in Rome, Constantine, when he converted to Christianity and made Christianity the religion of the empire, he decided to build a basilica, which at the basilica isn't a Christian thing, it's a Roman thing.
Right, a basilica. So a basilica in ancient Rome is a large interior space that's cordoned off by columns. So, like, they have a large colonnade where you could have court proceedings, you could have markets in there. A basilica is just basically a large space where the public goes. It's almost like a mall,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. So, the architectural style of the Roman basilica becomes the Catholic Church basilica.
Right, and that's because of Constantine. So Constantine orders a massive basilica built on Vatican Hill, which was situated outside of the city.
So Rome is traditionally built on seven hills. Vatican Hill is not one of the seven hills. So it's across, it's on the west side of the Tiber. All the other seven hills are on the
east side
of the Tiber. And Nero's Circus, which is where Peter was crucified, with, I think by the time of Constantine, had fell into disrepair. They didn't use it.
Right.
So the burial sites, like the necropolis around it, were kind of encroaching into what was the circus.
Yeah, so he picks a spot that to people of the time was completely random. It's, why is he going outside the city to build this big, massive building? But in order to build it, they have to level the ground. So they fill it with dirt and stone, and they flatten the ground and make the ground stable to erect this massive basilica that then was the centerpiece of the Roman church for 1,200 years. Before he builds the church, Constantine then encases the trophy / monument that existed in marble, and that was the altar of the new basilica.
The Constantinian Basilica.
Yeah. Then, in the late 1400s, early 1500s, the popes at the time, you had Pope Sixtus IV, who built the Sistine Chapel. He decides that he wants to fix the old basilica because it's in disrepair. But he dies before that he's able to do it. There's a few popes in between, and then his nephew, Julius II, becomes pope after Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope. And Julius II is one of the, I guess, the... He's
the
corrupt.
The epitome of a Renaissance pope.
Yeah. Well, he's the other side of the Borgia coin. So mm-hmm. you have
Not
the Borgia pope...
Depraved.
Well, he was, but you have the Borgia pope who was just depraved, whereas Julius had his own peccadilloes, but then he... If the popes were to be an emperor, he was... He's the epitome of that.
And he picked his name because of...
Right.
Caesar.
Right. So he decided that he wanted to glorify the city of Rome, which had fallen into disrepair. At the time, Florence and Venice were much... And Milan, even, were much bigger cities. They had more thriving economies, better buildings, all the artists were there. Rome was in shambles. So Julius decides, I want to fix up St. Peter's. And he hires Donato Bramante to inspect it. He's a famous architect from Florence. And after months, Bramante comes back and says, rather than rebuild the old church, let's tear it down and build an even bigger church that's more magnificent, and it'll be your church. So Julius, who is known as, I don't know the Italian, the terrible pope.
Hold on. Papale Tenevale?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And he's also the warrior pope because he marched into battle a few times.
Is he the only pope that went into battle? Because I remember in history class, like in high school, they were like, oh, the popes used to lead armies into battle, and recently I'm like, which popes
were Well, I think they? Leo was the one who met Attila the Hun, but I don't know if he not marching, fought
no, he didn't,
in
no,
battle. He didn't. Julius is...
It might just
he
be
might be the only one.
I feel like when people...
There's a lot of popes. So Julius decides to build a new basilica. Bramante comes up with this plan. At the time, he also commissions Michelangelo to build this massive tomb that's going to be the centerpiece of the church, and it's going to have 40 sculptures. It's going to be 100 feet tall.
And one of the sculptures is the Moses.
Right. Statue, so the very so famous the, Moses statue. The irony about the tomb is that Michelangelo dedicates himself to doing this tomb, and the first statue that he makes is of Moses, but he makes Moses' face based on Julius. And then all of a sudden Julius cancels the project, and he instead tells Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel. And
one of the most famous, it's probably the Creation of Adam and the Mona Lisa are probably the two most famous pieces of art in history.
Yeah, and the Last Supper.
And the Last Supper, yeah.
And then if you want to bring in sculpture, the David.
Yeah, but I mean like a painting or yeah. a fresco.
So Michelangelo paints the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel while Bramante starts building massive piers that will hold up the dome of St. Peter's. And Bramante ends up dying, I think in 1514 or so, and the painter Raphael becomes the new architect, and Raphael and Michelangelo don't get along, they hate each other, and at the time Raphael was the young prodigy, and he painted the School of Athens, which is in the palace that's next to the Sistine Chapel.
Right. So I think for anyone that has not been to Rome or Vatican City, all of these buildings are connected.
Yeah.
So you can walk through the Vatican Museums into the Sistine Chapel, then into St. Peter's Basilica, and never step foot outside.
Yeah. Basically, they expect the church to be finished at least within a half a century. Because at the time, churches took many years to build. But architects didn't last too long. They died before they could really get things off the ground. So there's a period of time where there's not much happening. And Michelangelo, he comes back to paint the Last Judgment, which is on the wall of the Sistine Chapel. And this is, I think he's in his 50s or 60s at the time. So this is 30 years after he does the Sistine Chapel. And then while he's painting that, the Pope at the time tells him that, well, now you're the architect. So Michelangelo actually sees the start of the dome being built, and then he dies in the 1560s. And the St. Peter's isn't finished until 1626, I want to say. So another 60 years before it's consecrated. And then on top of that, Bernini hadn't even begun to decorate the inside and build the colonnade
right.
and the baldacchino, which is the massive canopy that is made of so much bronze that Rome had to strip the Pantheon, and they had to break down all these old statues to then build. And in the process of building the baldacchino, which I'll include a picture in the show notes so people have a frame of reference, it was so heavy that they had to bore massive holes into St. Peter's and go under the ground to build a foundation. And in the process, they disturbed the tombs that were buried underneath the original surface of the ground. They didn't want to disturb everything because they thought that if they dug further, that the whole massive church and the dome would collapse. So they ignored it.
Yeah, I remember reading that. So, right, the Baldacchino comes later.
Yeah, it's like the 1630s.
And the reason they did it was because they felt that the high altar, which was the above the tomb, got lost. Like, you couldn't see, you wouldn't know exactly where it was, so they wanted a distinguishing feature that marked the tomb.
Yeah.
So they built the baldacchino over it. And I think an interesting thing about the baldacchino is the columns on it. So,
yeah,
the columns on it are replicas of the columns that would have been in the temple in Jerusalem.
Right, so they're spiral.
Right, so they're it's like a... Yeah, it's almost like a helix kind of looking spiral that works its way up.
Yeah, and another funny thing about St. Peter's is that there are pictures of, or little emblems of bees everywhere. And when we were there, we were saying, what is this? So I looked it up, and in my readings after, the bee was part of the coat of arms of Urban the Eighth, who's the Pope who hired Bernini to finish St. Peter's.
He's Barberini.
He's a Barberini. And the phrase that the Italians would say, because the names were so similar, they would say what the barbarians couldn't do to Rome, the Barberini did, because it was Urban the Eighth who stripped all the monuments of their bronze.
And if you go to Piazza Barberini in Rome, you'll see the bees show up again.
Uh-huh.
Bees are all over the place, though.
Yeah.
Napoleon also takes the image of the bee.
That's a whole conversation we can have another day.
Between Paris and Rome, I keep seeing bees everywhere.
That's the history of St. Peter's in the Middle Ages. And then years pass, and the popes go from being decadent and immoral to, like, the popes of the 18th and 19th centuries are very much the epitome of monks and the popes that we imagine today, and for the most part. It wasn't until World War II when they were building a tomb for Pius the 11th, who had died in 1939, and in the process of building a tomb, because the grotto, there's a grotto underneath St. Peter's, but it's above the old necropolis.
Yeah, so that grotto is more like the first floor of the church.
So in the process of digging in the grotto, these their workmen, they fell through the floor into a Roman tomb that hadn't been disturbed in 2,000 years. Pius XII at the time, he had just become the new pope, and World War II might have just started. So he said, this could be a crazy thing that we can find the tomb of St. Peter that we've known has been here all this time, but we haven't had proof. But then there's also the chance that we might not find it, and that could be...
in our church that's not built on the
rock. Right, and just to backtrack a little, because we skipped over this, the process of building St. Peter's took 150 years. It also caused the Reformation, or it's one of the main causes of the Reformation. So the fact that if St. Peter wasn't buried under the church, it would have created a real big story. So the Vatican, like they always do, they keep things secretive. So they proceeded to excavate under the Vatican during the entire war.
Secretly. Just in case Peter's not here.
And they found the tomb that they thought to be Peter's in 1948, I believe. And they still kept it secret because they weren't sure, because they had to do testing on the bones and everything. And then, of course, it leaked in the early 1950s, and they finally announced, oh, we found St. Peter's bones. And then it wasn't until the 60s when they hired a female archaeologist, Margherita Guarducci, who proceeded to prove that the bones that they had found was not in fact Peter's, but that other bones that they had found and just threw into a storeroom were actually
Peter,
the first popes. So the bones that they originally had found, after doing testing, they found that they were a few different members of a family and that there were some female bones, and but the bones that they had cast aside were all from one person, and that
the feet were missing.
Which so would have made sense, since
would have probably chopped off his body from the feet
because he was hanging upside down, and it was a 5'7", I think, somebody who was robust and would have been in his 60s, which fit St. Peter. So the church is 95% sure that those are St. Peter's remains, and they then put some of the remains back in the hole in the marble structure that Constantine built. And that's what you see when you're in the Scavi tour. You see a hole in the structure, and there's graffiti all over the wall. And this archaeologist, Guarducci, she discovered that some of the graffiti says, like, Petros is here. So all these things line up that that's Peter. Some of Peter's remains, though, are kept in the papal residence. So the Pope, I think it was John Paul II, when he was shot in 1981, one of the first things he said when he woke up was that, I want to be with Peter. So they brought him Peter's remains, which I think is really cool.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So the only relics of Peter are in, one's under the Basilica, obviously, and the other's in the Papal Residence.
I think they might have some in other boxes, but I think they're all in the Vatican. Like, they're not out at other churches.
Right, they're not in, like, Greece or something. No. Like it's all in Vatican City.
No. The Scavi tour itself, we start at one end.
We start at the front of the church, basically.
We start at the front of the church, and we also start at the lowest point.
Right.
And then we work our way up, because St. Peter's tomb is literally right under the altar of this chapel that's in the grotto. So then we got to go into that chapel after, and...
Right, and during the Scavi tour, you're walking uphill.
Yeah.
And it noticed that.
The thing that stuck me in the Scavi tour is that it doesn't feel like you're in a museum. It feels like you are in...
An ancient Roman excavation site.
Because it's...
It feels like a town.
It looks like a town because there are streets.
Right. It's like you have streets and with doors.
Stone buildings. Because it's like the cemetery in New Orleans.
Right.
That has the above-ground mausoleums. It's just underground. So the air was very damp and musty. It just felt like nothing I've ever experienced. And you could see that they had these clear plexiglass doors that would automatically open when we moved into new areas, and you could see there was condensation on the doors, so they really kept it, it's like temperature
control.
I think they've removed some of the bodies, but some of the bodies I think are still in the tombs. And I mean, we saw there were some pagan tombs that had statues and mosaics, and then there were a few Christian tombs that were masked to be pagan. Like one of the tombs that our guide told us was a Christian tomb because it had some imagery of like fishermen, but then there was it Helios or Apollo.
So Christ was made to look like a sun god. It's not the long-haired, bearded Jesus figure. It's rays of sun, spiky rays of sun coming out of his head.
Yeah, like riding a chariot.
And it's like, you, when you're looking at these tombs, it's like, I don't know how you could have figured this out.
Yeah, like I just think they look for certain clues.
I guess identified it, and it's just like, I don't know how you guys did this.
I don't know. But it was such a fascinating experience.
And then we're eventually led up to the main grotto floor.
Right. So we're in the papal chapel there that has a gilded gold ceiling. And
right. And then, so that level leads to, like, if you were to walk down the stairs under the baldacchino, you go to the sepulcher of Peter, which, you know, there's tons and tons of pictures. And it's also the site in the movie Angels and Demons where the Camerlengo burns himself to death.
And then right above that is the main altar. So you...
So going from
the grotto, you take these staircases that are built into the giant piers of Bramante that then hold up the dome, and you come out on the floor. And St. Peter's is so massive. You really... Pictures don't do it justice. You were saying, though, you don't know how other churches fit inside it, because they have
So St. Peter's Basilica has what are called papal medallions that run down the center of the nave from the front of the church to right before the baldacchino. So right around the dome area. They're a collection of churches from around the world. So St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, Notre Dame, Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., churches in Brazil. And so it's like a collection of the largest churches on the planet. And the medallions are showing you the length, I guess, of the church in relation to St. Peter's, where you are.
Yeah.
So they're measuring it from the very back of the church, so the altar of the chair, and they're measuring towards the front of the building, towards the front door. And St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York is the smallest out of all of them. So it's the first papal medallion closest to the high altar. And when you're standing there at St. Patrick's medallion and you're looking towards the back of the church, I don't know if they're using Italian measurements here, but I cannot for the life of me picture St. Patrick's Cathedral being able to fit lengthwise in that space. It does not look long enough. Like St. Patrick's Cathedral looks larger to me than the length that they're telling me it is in the Vatican.
And there's really no way to
determine if it's true or not. Yeah, I've looked this up a million times. Just like, just, you know, determining the size of the church is ambiguous. It's like, you know, well, certain volume, churches are higher, length. Certain churches are longer. What type of internal volume do they have? What type of floor space do they have? What type of grounds do they have? So it's all kind of ambiguous. It's like, what, in what way are you measuring a church? I found St. Peter's Basilica to be, like, if you look at it diagonally from where the Pietà is on the right side by the front of the church towards the back, I find its size comes alive when you look at it in a diagonal setting. Right. More so than looking at it straight on from the front door to the back.
Well, that's how all of the major basilicas felt. They're very wide. You get the sense that, wow, this building is massive. Yeah. So yeah, so then after the Scavi tour, we got to go up to the dome.
Right, so...
So it wasn't a tour. We got to just do it on our own.
We could have taken an elevator, but we won't.
Yeah, so that's open to the public. You just have to wait online. So we waited a little bit, and then you climb up. It's a really, really wide spiral staircase. It's almost a ramp. And then you get to the roof, and then you go into the dome, into the drum of the dome. And you get to stand... So now you're in the dome looking down. I don't know how high we were, probably 300 feet. It doesn't look that high when you're standing on the ground.
It looked very high being up there.
But the people were ants.
Yeah, I agree. I thought the church looked so much larger being up in the dome than it did looking at the dome from the ground. And so, when we were there, a Latin mass was going on.
Right, in one of the side chapels. So that was
so you could hear the really Latin. Cool.
And then we now left the interior rim to then go in the staircases that are in between. So it's Michelangelo's design. So the inside wasn't completed in his lifetime, but it was his design. And then the outside was actually built more ovular than his original design. His design was more like the Pantheon. So it was a shallower dome. Yeah. So we went in between the two domes with all these staircases that
are crooked and
I don't
on its side.
They didn't look ancient or they didn't look old. They look like
from a 1960s high school.
Right. But they're going in weird directions and then eventually
you have to hold onto a rope.
Yeah, so then we have to hold onto a rope because it's literally a spiral staircase with no railing because it's so tight. And then you're on top in the lantern, what they call it, and there are bars going all the way around so you can't fall off, but it doesn't seem that secure,
especially when you're holding your phone outside of that and there's no way to get that if you drop
it. And honestly, I felt more claustrophobic standing outside in the lantern than inside on the staircase because there were so many people packed into that little area.
Yeah, and especially on the front, like looking out towards St. Peter's Square.
Yeah.
Because everyone wants that picture. It's much more crowded on that, on the, what would it be, the east side of the dome than the west side.
Yeah, it was pretty tight. But it reminded me of the Eiffel Tower. Like, oh, we climbed up and now we're looking out on the city and it's not like we're seeing a skyline per se because there aren't big skyscrapers. It's not like going to the top of the Empire State Building, but we're looking down on everything, we could see everything, and then there's just a lot of people.
Right.
It's kind of a completely different feel than the Scavi tour, but it was poetic that we went below and then above in the same day. And then from St. Peter's, we went to St. Paul Outside the Walls.
Yeah, so I thought it was also poetic that we went to we saw the tomb of St. Peter and St. Paul in the same day.
Yeah.
So we did the Scavi tour first, then we went to the top of the dome, then we went to the gift shop at the top of the dome. And then...
That's why it reminds me of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. So we went... It's like a little city on top of that church. Anyway, so after St. Peter's, we went to St. Paul's Outside the Walls. So it's called St. Paul's Outside the Walls because it's outside the ancient city limits of Rome. It's outside the Aurelian Walls. So you have to travel south from the main city of Rome to get to St. Paul's. It's in what looks like a very bad area. So we're getting a cab, it's like, damn, I hope we can get a taxi back, you know, to the main city. St. Paul's has a very beautiful garden in front of it, I guess you would say, or a, I don't know what you would call it.
It looks like a tropical grotto.
Yeah, so there's palm trees, there's a really cool statue of St. Paul.
He looks like a warrior. He's holding a sword. Yeah. He looks like Tormund Giantsbane.
I think St. Paul's was the widest of the four major basilicas. So, to quickly go over the basilicas, in the Catholic world, the Roman Catholic world, every basilica on the planet that is not one of the four major basilicas in Rome is considered a minor basilica. So we live in North Jersey, so we're in the Archdiocese of Newark. The Cathedral Church of Newark is it's called the Cathedral Basilica of the Sacred Heart, which is a basilica, but it's a minor basilica. So the only major basilicas are all in the city of Rome. So you have St. Peter's Basilica, St. Paul's outside the walls, St. John Lateran, and St. Mary Major are the only four what are called papal basilicas. And they get that rank from being historical, old, ancient churches. So St. Paul's was the fourth one we visited, and
it's also technically the newest because it burned down in the 1800s. So it's largely been rebuilt. What you're seeing today. Yeah.
Personally, this one was my least favorite out of all four of them. I think St. Peter's is my favorite, but I really liked John Lateran. So John Lateran holds probably the most unique title in the entire Roman Catholic world as the Mother Church. So I believe in Latin it's Ecclesiae Mater, or Mater, yeah. So it's the Mother Church of the entire Catholic world. So unlike what most people would assume, the Cathedral of Rome is not St. Peter's Basilica. The Cathedral of Rome is John Lateran.
And that's because Constantine gave the Lateran Palace
to
the church.
So when Constantine fights the Battle of the Milvian Bridge for the fate of Rome, Maxentius has a barracks that are on the site of what would become St. John Lateran. And it's owned, I think, by the Lateran family, the Laterani. And Constantine gives the Roman church the Lateran site. And that is the first, it's the first site that Constantine gives the church. So therefore it's the oldest in terms of the structures of churches that are built in Rome over any of these sites. St. Peter's has had a tradition of the tomb site of Peter having, you know, altars and this and that are older than that. But for a church, the Lateran Palace and the Lateran Church is the oldest, which is why it becomes the Cathedral of Rome. So it's where the Bishop of Rome sits, and
we saw his chair.
Yeah, so the Pope's Bishop's chair is in John Lateran. And it's, I think, the only church on the planet that's considered an archbasilica. So it's a major basilica, and it's an archbasilica, and it's a cathedral. So I don't think any other church in the world has that title. And I really like John Lateran.
John Lateran was really cool. It had 12 statues of the apostles, but instead of Judas, it was St. Paul. But they were massive, 10 feet tall.
Lying the main nave.
My favorite was St. Matthew. He's reading a book, and it's like he's fighting a battle reading the book, and that's how I feel when I open books. I'm like, I feel so tough and strong reading my book. I thought it was funny.
I know. You said it to me. Like, this is how I feel when I read books.
The largest obelisk, ancient obelisk in the world, is outside of John Lateran. Which, it doesn't look as big because it's not in this courtyard. Like the Caligula's obelisk, which was moved from Nero's circus to the front of the basilica, which is a whole big production in the Middle Ages. Renaissance, actually.
I love that. The main obelisk in St. Peter's Square was brought from Egypt to Rome by Caligula.
Yeah.
Love it.
It shows the church repurposes things.
Caligula.
John Lateran is a giant statue of Constantine. I think think St. Peter's did too.
And John Lateran is also across from the Scala Sancta, which right. is the Holy Stairs.
So the Scala Sancta were, they were part of the original palace, which I think Julius also tore down, because Julius messed everything up.
Mm-hmm. Pope Julius.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the Scala Sancta, they're, so the tradition is that when St. Helena, who is the mother of Emperor Constantine, went to the Holy Land, she cited out all the holy sites in Israel, so she's kind of responsible for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the a lot of the sites that you'll go to in the Holy Land if you visit it. And she brought things back to Rome from it. So one of the things she's supposed to have brought back was the staircase that Christ took up to meet Pontius Pilate at his, his interrogation. And I remember when I went to Israel, we were standing outside of, I remember it was like a city wall or something, and our tour guide was like, this most likely would have been where the staircase up to Pilate's palace was, or into the fortress. And he says, but the staircase isn't here because it's in Rome. I'm like, okay, whatever. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess when I go to Rome, I'll have to see it. So I ended up seeing it. So the tradition then is, or the pious tradition of pilgrims that go to Rome and go to the Holy Stairs, is that you go up on your knees. And we did that.
And the stairs are, they've removed the wooden covering recently. So it was under renovation for a while.
So not intentionally, we didn't go to Rome at this time, but we were fortunate enough to go to Rome when they removed the wooden covering that normally covers the stairs, the marble stairs, because they're so concave from years and years and years of people going up them. So they removed them, and we actually went up on the marble, not on wood.
Right. And,
which is pretty cool.
And because there were a lot of people, we're stopping every step for a few minutes, and you're trying to put your knee on hard stone that's almost sharp because it's so concave. Right. It was pretty rough.
Yes.
It was really cool though.
Yeah, I really liked the Holy Stairs.
There's a quote which I saw on Wikipedia. Charles Dickens at least observed people going up the Scala Sancta on their knees, and he thought it was despicable that it was such a waste of time. But he was, I think, pretty secular for his time.
He was secular, not Protestant. He was
both. I think he was mm-hmm. Anglican, but also
okay.
Especially at the time, it's like everybody thought Catholics are crazy.
Yeah, you know what sucks? Great Expectations. That's all I have to say about that.
Well, but A Tale of Two Cities is good.
I haven't read that, so oh well.
Anyway.
Scott Mary Sons is well, better than Charles Dickens.
Well, Mary Major,
I really like Mary Major.
For some reason, I have a mental block at what Mary Major looks like. I remember the big Pius IX statue that was there.
And Bernini's buried in Mary Major. He's buried close to the altar. I was very impressed by Mary Major. There is a statue in Mary Major of Mary.
What is that, shock. The icon?
No. It was a statue of the Madonna and Child that I really liked.
But they also have that icon.
Oh, yes.
Famous, I forget what it's called.
Yeah, it was some icon or picture. A picture of a painting.
From like 400 AD. As also the ceiling of Mary Major is gilded with the first gold taken from the New World. So yay, colonialism.
We're clinking rum, you know, the drink of colonialism.
I think this will be a good transition between Catholic Rome and ancient Rome, which was the other half of our trip, but I don't know how much time we'll have to discuss that. But the first day we went to St. Peter's, we just went and we took pictures and we prayed in some of the chapels. But then leaving just across, still on the same side of the river, but across the giant street that Mussolini built outside of the Vatican, you have Castle San Angelo, which was the fortress that the Pope built on top of Hadrian's mausoleum that at least two popes escaped to on this long secret bridge that was out
in
the open.
I'm putting secret in air quotes. They're like, oh, there's a secret passageway from the Vatican to Castel San Angelo, and it's pretty quite in the open. It's
it looks like an
there
aqueduct.
It is. It's like, here, I see the guy with the white hat on. It's like, let's shoot our arrows at him.
So at least two times in history, I know the second time was Clement the VII in 1527 when Charles V's Holy Roman Empire, Lutheran mercenaries sacked the city. And
I think the German term was long's necks or something for the soldiers that attacked.
So the
Swiss Guard made their last stand.
Yeah, they sacked the city. The Swiss Guard made their last stand on the steps of St. Peter's while Clement VII and a bunch of other dignitaries ran across the secret tunnel to Castle San Angelo. We got to the Castle San Angelo.
We had an hour left in the castle. And I think we were both very impressed by it.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting
I guess I wasn't expecting anything. I was like, oh, I wanted to go to Castel San Angelo because I've seen it a million times. It's famous. But I didn't have an expectation for what it was like.
Just like the top of St. Peter's felt like the Eiffel Tower, the top of Castel San Angelo felt like the top of the Arc de Triomphe, where it's about the same height. So you're looking at the city from the same height. And just the interior was sort of similar, like going up spiral staircases and with the statues and everything on top. But it was like we were in a medieval fortress.
I don't think I've ever been in a castle, like a real...
Like we saw armaments and...
Me personally, I don't think of Italy being medieval. Like when I think of medieval things, I think of England and Ireland and Scotland, like their castles. And from the outside, I would say Castel San Angelo does not look particularly medieval.
Well, because when you go in it, it's just round.
Yeah, but when you go in it, it was like, oh, I could have been on some Game of Thrones set. Like, it looked very medieval.
Yeah, we're looking
at... It looked like I was in a castle.
We're looking out the little windows and we're seeing...
Right, it had, like the building had crenellations for archers and things like that on the castle walls.
Yeah, at a few parts they were just holes for where, I guess, soldiers would be knocking arrows.
Right,
and
the crenellations, yeah.
But there were holes, so it's like if we took a step, we could have fallen through.
Right, that's Italian for you.
Yeah.
We don't have safety.
But then there's a restaurant up there. Yeah, and
which is really
cool. It would have been cool to eat up there, but we didn't have time.
And then the very top has the large statue of St. Michael, which... was really cool. And then the bridge that leads across the Tiber to Castel San Angelo is, I think it's called the Bridge of the Angels or something. So there's statues of all different angels that lead to it, which looks really cool.
Especially at night.
But it's
built on the original site
of Emperor Hadrian's tomb. So the foundation of Castel San Angelo is the tomb that was built for the Emperor Hadrian. So Hadrian is one of the, you know, quote-unquote, five good emperors in the golden age of Rome. Hadrian was pretty prominent in the city, I felt. Like, there were statues of Hadrian.
I think it was especially Hadrian through Commodus, before the decline. We have a lot of, I guess, sources from that time period, both written... We have buildings from that time period, and we have statues from that time period. Whereas before and after, it's kind of hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
But like out of going to the Louvre, the Vatican Museum, the Capitoline Museum, and just being around Rome and Paris, there's a ton of statues and busts of the emperors in that time period.
Right.
The Pantheon is from Hadrian's time period. There are so many more statues of Hadrian, Lucius Verus, Marcus Aurelius, and Commodus, and even Antoninus Pius, than any other emperor in all the museums I've seen so far in Europe.
Yeah, it's the bearded emperors. It's like the bearded emperors.
That all look alike.
It's either Hadrian or Marcus Aurelius. I think it might be my favorite site in Rome was the Forum. So we did a tour of the Colosseum. So we started at the Colosseum, which was amazing.
Which is so much bigger than I thought it would be.
Yeah, so the Colosseum's built by the Flavians, so technically it's not really called the Colosseum. It's called the Flavian Amphitheater. It started by Vespasian, and it's finished by his son Titus. And, I mean, I love the Colosseum. It's the symbol of Rome, in probably even more than St. Peter's. It's
oh, yeah.
The de facto, it's like, oh, you see the Roman Colosseum, that's Rome. So we did the Colosseum tour, and then we went to Palatine Hill, which I was, you know...
There's not much there, but it was cool just to be there.
So Palatine Hill is the site of the imperial palaces of the Roman emperors. So to answer Alan's question from The Hangover, did Caesar really live here? Yes, he did really live in Palatine Hill. I love Palatine Hill, just to be in the presence of the imperial palaces. And like you said, it's not like
there's... Right, there's ruins, there. But there's
ruins, but it's not... You're not getting a full scope of what... You know what it would have looked like, but it's like, oh, I'm in the presence of greatness here.
Right.
So, Palatine Hill is also, I guess, the oldest site, even from the kingdom period of Rome. So traditionally, the Romulus and Remus, when they are found by the she-wolf on the banks of the Tiber, they're on the banks of the Tiber on Palatine Hill. So it's not Capitoline Hill, which is very important, but it's Palatine Hill.
Right.
Speaking
of the she-wolf, to go on a little tangent,
mm-hmm.
Wasn't that your favorite thing in Rome?
Yes, so the very famous Roman wolf statue of Romulus and Remus suckling on the she-wolf is in the Capitoline Museum.
That was in the presence of greatness.
I'm sorry. I'm going to get such crap for this, but I like the Sistine Chapel. Sistine Chapel's great, but I felt like there was no comparison in my emotions between being in the Sistine Chapel to being in the presence of the Roman wolf.
Right, but we're in the presence of the Roman wolf alone. It's in a small room. We can take a picture next.
I agree. So the Roman wolf statue is 2,500 years old. Okay, it's the statue of the founding twin brothers Romulus and Remus of the city. I don't know. I find it amazing. I'm just like, I could sit in the presence of this statue forever. Like this is what being in the Holy of Holies must have felt like.
I don't disagree with you. I just think, because I like the Sistine Chapel a lot, but being in the Sistine Chapel, because it was so crowded, it was like we were sardines in a can.
Yeah. I mean,
so it doesn't feel holy, whereas being in St. Peter's did feel a little more like that.
Right, there's no quiet
being
space.
Next to the wolf was like a spiritual experience because we had quiet and could just sit and look at it. Sistine Chapel, we're also 70 feet below, and there's a ton of people. It sounds like a football stadium.
But
it's the opposite effect of what you would expect seeing the Mona Lisa or something.
Right, but it's but forget any of that. It's an ancient statue. Mm-hmm. Like the Sistine Chapel is an ancient painting or fresco.
That's pretty damn old. It's not 2,500 years old.
It's not,
but
it's actually that old.
Charlton Heston got paint in his eye painting that.
Charlton Heston. So the statue is 2,500 years old. I find it amazing. I think it's cool. But it's like, oh, these are my ancestors. It's like my ancestors built this Roman wolf statue.
Yeah.
So anyway, So past Palatine Hill, you walk into the Roman Forum, and that's where our tour ended.
Yeah.
So we walked from Palatine Hill to the end of the Roman Forum, which basically ends at Capitoline Hill. And so the Roman Forum starts around the Arch of Titus, which has the big relief of the Roman legion sacking the city of Jerusalem, bringing out the menorah from the temple. Arch of Titus is also the blueprint for the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, which is also the blueprint for the Washington Square Arch in New York. We then made our way down, and you can see that, you know, different temples, the Temple of Castor and Pollux, the Temple, the very, very minimal remains of the Temple of Jupiter.
And they're all famous ruins.
Yeah,
they don't
very, very
really look ruins. Like anything now, but they're well-known images.
Castor and Pollux is probably one of the more famous.
Yeah, that was the images. Three, right?
It's like,
the three
yeah, columns. The three columns. And then there's one piece where it's the part of the forum where it's believed that Mark Antony laid out the body of the dead Julius Caesar. So,
and that's where he would have said, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears," but in Marlon Brando's accent
and English.
Yeah.
Yeah, not Latin. So on the spot, it's kind of blocked, so you have to kind of walk behind this wall.
And it's like going in a little house.
Yeah, it's very enclosed. And it's funny because the site is 2,100 years old. People throw coins and they throw flowers and bouquets. And it's just funny. It's like people are paying tribute to this man that's ancient, literally ancient. And it's not a religious site. You know, it's not like I'm paying money to go see, the site of Peter, right? Yeah. It's
like
just,
Lourdes.
It's right.
But it was my personal Lourdes.
Oh my God. So we both paid our monetary tribute to the man, the myth, the legend, Julius Caesar. Yeah. So we both threw a coin for Caesar.
Veni vidi vici.
It's veni vidi vici. So for those of you that are gonna jump on me, I like my V's in Latin. They sound like V's, not W's.
I met Barry Strauss last week, the author of 10 Caesars. And he said, "Veni, vidi, vici." So I trust the Roman scholar.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound as cool. So I'm going to go with veni, vidi, vici. And then probably my other most spiritual, ancient pagan Roman experience.
Drinking Sambuca outside the Pantheon?
No. But it was seeing the statue of the Augustus of Prima Porta. So it's probably easily the most famous Roman statue out there of a Caesar, of
well, it's the statue
emperor.
You see when you go to Caesar's in Atlantic
yeah, so
City
if,
in
if
Vegas.
You've ever been to Caesar's Palace, this the statue that you're constantly encountering is the Augustus of Prima Porta. So it's Augustus, who's the first Roman emperor, grandnephew of Julius Caesar. He's Augustus Caesar is also my favorite historical person. So the Augustus of Prima Porta statue is the one where Augustus Caesar has his right hand up. There's a little cherub angel below him, looking up lovingly at him. This statue, I find, is amazing. So, personally, when me, Steve, and one of our other friends went to Las Vegas 3 years ago, I believe, at this point, or almost 3 years ago.
What year is it? 2019.
What year is it? It's
2019. Yeah, it was almost 3 years ago.
Okay. So, we went to Las Vegas as... Obviously, I love Roman history, so I'm like, oh, I need a big bust of Caesar. And they had a big bust of Augustus Caesar in one of the gift shops in Caesar's Palace. It was $125, and it's almost life-size, but it's big.
It's big enough to not fit on a plane.
Yeah, it's big and it's heavy. And I bought it for $125, and I'm walking down Las Vegas Boulevard with this enormous, because they wrapped in a bubble wrap, this and a big Caesar's Palace bag.
And we were so far from Caesar's. I completely forgot that you had to carry it back to the
hold
hotel.
On. So I'm walking out of Caesar's Palace. It's heavy. And I'm like, I cannot walk back to the Luxor with this thing. So we ended up having to get a cab because I was going to die in the 110 degree heat with Augustus Caesar holding him lovingly. So... Anyway, stupid me, I'm like, oh, I'll put him in the suitcase and not carry him on the plane because, you know, I should have had it shipped to my house. But no, I was stupid. So
well, it'll cost like $300 to ship
whatever.
It home.
So I put the stupid... It's not stupid.
You
Lord,
stupidly put
Lord
the amazing
me.
Statue.
I stupidly put the Augustus Caesar statue into my suitcase and this Slavic... witch.
This nice lady.
This Slavic witch that works for JetBlue threw my bag onto the conveyor belt, and I'm like, oh my god, my $125 statue is broken. We get to JFK, and the first thing I do is open my bag, and I can already feel that the bust is in pieces, and I'm pissed. and I'm pissed the whole way home. And so the bust was intact from the head down to the base, which, thank God. The shoulders were broken, and I painstakingly glued Augustus Caesar back together. And he is now sitting in my room, lovingly looking at me all the time.
And he looks ancient.
And he does look ancient because he's broken, so it looks like I actually stole something from Rome. So I have a long history with that particular image of Augustus Caesar.
I completely forgot about you walking down Las Vegas Boulevard.
I remember leaving the Bellagio. It was like, oh my God.
We still have a mile ago.
Like, there's no way I'm going to get to Luxor with this. So anyway, yeah.
I'm crying.
So being able to see the real version of the Augustus of Prima Porta was very cool, very special. One of the other really cool Roman buildings we went to was the Pantheon.
That was the first thing that we saw.
Yeah, well, yes, it was.
In Rome, right?
First sight. Definitely one of the first things we saw. The Pantheon, I find, is amazing. So initially, the original Pantheon is built by Augustus's second-in-command, Marcus Agrippa, and it's a temple with an oculus, which is an open center in the top of its ceiling in the dome.
Do you know how big that circle is?
No.
It's 27 feet across. It does not look that big.
It doesn't, no.
But that's how big the dome is, how high.
How big it is, yeah. And the Pantheon is dedicated to all the gods. That's, you know, when you say a pantheon of gods, that's what they're talking about. But it was destroyed, I think, by a fire. I'm not entirely sure how it was destroyed.
I think so.
But, again, here we go. Emperor Hadrian rebuilds the Pantheon. And because he's so humble, he still keeps the words of, you know, built by Marcus Agrippa on top of it. So the current Pantheon is from Hadrian's time. But I believe it's pretty much the exact same looking building that Agrippa built. But it's pretty cool.
Well, they studied the Pantheon when trying to build St. Peter's. And they spent a lot of time looking at the Pantheon saying, how the hell did Romans build this?
Mm-hmm.
Because the technology was lost through history. So they kind of had to recreate the idea of a dome. And they kind of used Brunelleschi's, which I don't think Brunelleschi left plans either, with the Duomo in Florence, which was built about 100, 150 years before St. Peter's started. But the Pantheon, they used as a model.
Mm-hmm. And if you go to Washington, D.C., and you look at the Jefferson Memorial, that's modeled after the Pantheon.
Well, the Pantheon in Paris is also modeled after it. But it also has a dome like the U.S. Capitol. The Pantheon looks new, and that's because it became a church very soon after it was built.
Yeah,
very
soon in historical terms. I don't even know what it's like. Santa Maria something, like St. Mary, yeah. The whatever.
It really doesn't look like a church, even though it is. They have a few altars and the pews, but it's a round building, so it's different.
And the really cool thing, so...
It's massive, too.
2 weeks ago was Pentecost.
Yeah.
So on Pentecost, a tradition that they always do at the Pantheon is they throw red rose petals from the top of the oculus down into the church. So it's like the descent of the fire.
Someone has to go up to the top of the roof and drop it.
Someone's on top of the Pantheon's roof throwing rose petals. And so it's the red fire of the Holy Spirit descending on the apostles. And it looks very pretty. If you just have to go on YouTube or Google to look at a picture of it. Or a video of it.
Do you have anything else to say about ancient Rome? Because I want to end on one story. So this is completely unrelated from both Catholicism and ancient Rome.
It's not unrelated.
Okay, it was ancient Roman themed, which is why
and foremost, let's just say, I hate the cold.
Yeah.
I hate it. Like, I could easily live in a 100 degrees every day.
Yeah, which is insane. I don't like the cold, but I'm also a normal person.
Like, I easily...
run 20 degrees cooler than everyone else. He's cold-blooded like the Slytherin he is.
I am. I'm a cobra. I'm a desert cobra. So anyway, I found this club. And I was like, oh, Steve, like, when we go to Rome, we gotta go to this ice club.
Because it was Roman Emperor themed.
Right, because I was looking up ancient Roman clubs, like things that were themed around it, and I'm like, oh, this looks cool. Like there's ice sculptures of Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar, or whatever. I'm like, oh, we should go. I'm like, silly me.
Yeah, so we go to this place. It's very small. I think we went. It was the night before we left, so it was a Sunday night, so it wasn't crazy. There were the two of us and maybe 5 or 6 other people when we first got there. But it was this tiny room that's a refrigerator, or a freezer, basically.
Completely underestimated how cold this place
was. So we're given giant...
It looks like the jacket you get when you get an X-ray.
They're like, yeah, you can stay as long as you want. And it was like they got 15 euro cover charge, and the first drink was on us. Yeah. And
so cold.
I was cold.
I was dying.
But Chris was so cold.
My body was shutting down.
So annoyed that, and we were both drinking. So I was in a ecstatic mood. And I was hysterically laughing for about 3 hours.
I was having grappa shots to warm up. It was so freaking cold. And
I tried to talk to... I struck up a conversation. I don't talk to strangers ever, but I was in such a good mood. I started talking to these British tourists that were there that they asked us what we had done in Rome.
Yeah, he's like, oh, what sites are you seeing? And we're like, oh, like, have you gone to the Vatican?
Like, the normal stuff.
And he looks at us. He's like almost like, oh, what is that? And it's like, what's wrong with you people? I'm freezing my ass off. He's pissing me off.
I also struck up a conversation with him because he was speaking English. I'm like, oh, yeah. They're British. I work for a British company. Let me strike up a conversation. He wanted nothing to do with this.
You were having such a good time.
Okay.
You were
hysterical. I was too happy for this place.
I know.
And then there were a bunch of... All of a sudden, there was noise and loud Americans. And I said, oh, man, Americans.
I completely forgot about this.
So I went up to them and I said, oh, you guys are from America. Where are you from? Like, this is the first American I've really heard all week. And the one kid said, oh, we're from California. Where are you from? I said, well, I'm from New Jersey, but my friend here is from Florida. And they just looked at Chris and are like, wow, no wonder why he's so cold.
You're such a bastard. I'm like, labeled me as a Floridian when I've never lived in Florida ever in my life.
It's one of my favorite things I've
been from New
ever
Jersey
done
my entire life.
In my entire life.
I was so pissed off. I'm like, ugh.
I
need
so
to get the
funny.
Hell out of here.
So funny. And then we left about 2 minutes later. But that's one of the most fun I've ever had at a bar. And I was cold, too. But it was just so funny.
Well, I was shutting down.
Yeah.
I felt like Rose at the end of Titanic. I felt like Jack at the end of Titanic, where he's just shutting
Jack,
down.
Come back.
I just completely froze to death.
Well, on that note, unless you have anything else to say about Rome.
I would just say, not about Rome, but to talk about next podcast about rum and pirates.
Yeah, so we talked about Rome. We want to talk about rum.
So, yesterday was the first day of summer, and every summer we get into a very pirate mood, so...
Because we're children.
Yeah, exactly. So, we've been drinking rum for the past 2 weeks.
Because we're alcoholics.
Exactly. So, we've been drinking rum, watching Black Sails, and we normally always watch Pirates of the Caribbean, all 5 movies over the summer. So our next
because
we're losers. So we're loser alcoholic children. So the next podcast we want to do is probably talking about rum
and pirates.
And pirates. So both
and, wait,
fictional
just,
and historical.
Just to show that I'm being an academic, I'm currently reading The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard. I probably won't finish it by the time we but I'll have.
And I'm listening to a podcast about.
Right. You're being the millennial
pirate,
and I'm being
the history of pirates.
Yeah. So the next podcast will be about rum and pirates, and it should be more
both fictional and historical.
Yeah.
And
less
fictional.
Rambly than this.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah,
to
thank
our
you
for... Rome podcast.
Thank you for listening, and I would only suggest that if you want to go to Rome and actually see the Scavi tour, to book it months in advance, because our trip is planned too last minute, and we lucked out, but it took a lot.
Yeah.
Because I highly... That was my favorite thing in Rome, and it's one of my favorite things I've ever done in terms of traveling. So, with that, I'll spruce up our show notes with some pictures and maybe some links to things. I highly recommend the book Basilica by R.A. Scotti, which is the building of St. Peter's Basilica, and also The Fisherman's Tomb, which is about the discovery of the Scotti tour by John O'Neill. And, yeah, we'll see you next time.